It would appear that their comradeship was lacking, Yefremov observed dryly. So, Provorov, do you have anything to add? No, it would seem that you have covered all likely investigative avenues. Thank you. Since it remains a murder case, you will accompany us when we make the arrest. The American who assisted us? He may come along, Yefremov said generously. We'll show him how we do things here in Russia. Riley was back in the U.S. Embassy on the stoo, talking to Washington. Holy shit, the agent observed. That about covers it, Director Murray agreed. How good's their presidential protective detail? Pretty good. As good as the Secret Service? I don't know what their investigative support is like, but on the physical side, I'd have to say they're okay. Well, they've certainly been warned by now. Whatever they have is going to be perked up a notch or two. When will they do the takedown on this Suvorov guy? Smart move is to sit on it until he makes a move. Figure the Chinese will get the word to him soon. Like now, I suppose. And then he'll make some phone calls. That's when I'd put the arm on him and not before. Agreed, Murray observed. We want to be kept informed on all this. So stroke your cop friend, will you? Yes, sir. Riley paused. This war scare is for real? It looks that way, Murray confirmed. We're ramping up to help them out, but I'm not sure how it's going to play out. The president's hoping that the NATO gig will scare them off, but we're not sure of that either. The agency's running in circles trying to figure the PRC out. Aside from that, I don't know much. That surprised Riley. He'd thought Murray was tight with the president, but supposed now that this information was too compartmentalized. I'll take that, Colonel Aliyev said to the communications officer. It's for the immediate attention of... He needs sleep. To get to him, you must go through me, the operations officer announced, reading through the dispatches. This one can wait. This one I can take care of. Anything else? This one's from the president. President Grushevoy needs a lucid general more than he needs an answer to this, Pasha. Aliyev could use some sleep, too, but there was a sofa in the room, and its cushions were calling out to him. What's Tolkunov doing? Updating his estimate. Is he getting better in any way? Combs asked. What do you think? Ops replied. Shit. That's about right, comrade. Nowhere we can purchase chopsticks for us to eat with? Not while I have my service pistol, the colonel replied. At nearly 2 meters in height, he was much too tall to be a tanker or an infantryman. Make sure he sees these when he wakes. I'll fix it with Stavka. Good. I'm going to get a few hours, but wake me, not him, Aliyev told his brother officer. Da. They were small men in the main. They started arriving at Nevers, a small railroad town just east of Skovorodino, on day coaches tacked onto the regular rail service on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Getting off, they found officers in uniform directing them to buses. These headed down a road paralleling the railroad right-of-way, southeast toward a tunnel drilled ages before in the hills over the diminutive Urkhan River. Beside the tunnel was an opening which appeared to the casual viewer to be a siding for service equipment for the railroad. And so it was. But this service tunnel went far into the hillside, and branching off it were many more, all constructed in the 1930s by political prisoners, part of Joseph Stalin's Gulag labor empire. In these man-made caverns were 300 T-55 tanks, built in the mid-1960s and never used, but rather stored here to defend against an invasion from China, along with a further 200 BTR-60 wheeled infantry carriers, plus all the other rolling stock for a Soviet pattern tank division. The post was garrisoned by a force of 400 conscripts, who, like generations before them, served their time servicing the tanks and carriers, mainly moving from one to another, turning over the diesel engines and cleaning the metal surfaces, which was necessary because of water seepage through the stone roof. The Nevers Depot, it was called on classified maps, one of several such places close to the main rail line that went from Moscow to Vladivostok. Cunningly hidden, partially in plain sight, it was one of the aces that General Colonel Bondarenko had hidden up his sleeve. As were the men. They were mostly in their 30s, confused, and more than a little angry at having been called away from their homes. However, like good Russians, or indeed good citizens in any land, they got their notices, figured that their country had a need, and it was their country, and so about 3/4 of them went as summoned. Some saw familiar faces from their time in the conscript army of the Soviet Union. These men were mainly from that time, and greeted old friends, or ignored those less happily remembered. Each was given a pre-printed card telling him where to go, and so the tank crews and infantry squads formed up, the latter finding their uniforms and light weapons, plus ammunition, waiting in the assigned motor carrier. The tank crewmen were all small men, about 167 centimeters in height, about 5 feet 6 inches to an American, because the interiors of the old Russian tanks did not permit tall men to fit inside. The tankers, returning to the steeds of their youth, knew the good and bad points of the T-55s. The engines were made of roughly machined parts and would grind off a full kilogram of metal shavings into the oil sumps during the first few hours of running. But they all figured that would have been taken care of by the routine turning over of the engines in the depot. The tanks were, in fact, in surprisingly good shape, better than the ones they'd used on active duty. This seemed both strange and unsurprising to the returning soldiers, because the Red Army had made little logical sense when they'd been in it, but that, for a Soviet citizen of the 1970s and 80s, was not unexpected either. Most remembered their service with some fondness, and for the usual reasons, the chance to travel and see new, different things, and the comradeship of men their own age. A time of life in which young men seek out the new and the exciting. The poor food, miserable pay, and strenuous duty were largely forgotten, though exposure to the rolling equipment brought back some of it with the instant memory that accompanied smells and feels from the past. The tanks all had full internal fuel tanks, plus the oil drums affixed to the rear that had made all of the men cringe when thinking about a battlefield. One live round could turn every tank into a pillar of fire. And so that was the fuel you burned off first, just so you could pull the handle to dump the damn things off when the first bullet flew. Most agreeably of all, those who pressed the start buttons felt and heard the familiar rumble after only a few seconds of cranking. The benign environment of this cavern had been kind to these old but essentially unused tanks. They might have been brand new, fresh from the assembly lines of the massive factory at Nizhny Tagil, for decades the armory of the Red Army. The one thing that had changed, they all saw, was that the Red Star was gone from the glacis plate, replaced with an all-too-visible representation of their new white-blue-red flag, which, they all thought, was far too good an aiming point. Finally, they were all called away from their vehicles by the young reserve officers, who, they saw, looked a little worried. Then the speeches began, and the reservists found out why. "Damn, isn't she a lovely one," the FSS officer said, getting into the car. They'd followed their subject to yet another expensive restaurant, where he'd dined alone, then walked into the bar, and within 5 minutes fixed upon a woman who'd also arrived alone, pretty in her black, red-striped dress, that looked to have been copied from some Italian designer. Suvorov slash Konyev was driving back toward his flat, with a total of 6 cars in trail, 3 of them with light-change switches on their dashboards to alter their visual appearance at night. The cop riding in the number 2 car thought that was an especially clever feature. He was taking his time, not racing his car to show his courage, but instead dazzling the girl with his man-of-the-world demeanor, the investigators thought. The car slowed as it passed one corner, a street with old iron lampposts, then changed direction, if not abruptly, then unexpectedly. "Shit, he's going to the park," the senior FSS guy said, picking up his radio microphone to say this over the air. "He must have spotted a flag somewhere." And so he did. But first he dropped off what appeared to be a very disappointed woman, holding some cash in her hand to ease the pain. One of the FSS cars paused to pick her up for questioning, while the others continued their distant pursuit. And 5 minutes later it happened. Suvorov/Konyev parked his car on one side of the park and walked across the darkened grass to the other, looking about as he did so, not noticing the fact that five cars were circling. "That's it." He picked it up. He'd done it skillfully, but that didn't matter if you knew what to look for. Then he walked back to his car. Two of the cars headed directly over to his flat, and the three-in trail just kept going when he pulled in.
"He said he felt suddenly ill. I gave him my card," she told the interrogators. "He gave me 50 euros for my trouble."
Which was fair payment, she thought, for wasting half an hour of her valuable time. "Anything else? Did he look ill?"
"He said that the food suddenly disagreed with him. I wondered if he'd gotten cold feet, as some men do, but not this one. He is a man of some sophistication. You can always tell."
"Very well. Thank you, Yelena. If he calls you, please let us know."
"Certainly."
It had been a totally painless interview, which came as rather a surprise for her, and for that reason she'd cooperated fully, wondering what the hell she'd stumbled into. A criminal of some sort? Drug trafficker, perhaps. If he called her, she'd call these people and to hell with him. Life for a woman of her trade was difficult enough. "He's on the computer," an electronic specialist said at FSS headquarters. He read the keystrokes off the keyboard bug they'd planted, and they not only showed up on his screen, but also ran live on a duplicate of the subject desktop system. "There. There's the clear text. He's got the message." There was a minute or so of thoughtful pause, and then he began typing again. He logged onto his email service and started typing up messages. They all said some variant of, "Contact me as soon as you can." And that told them what he was up to. A total of 4 letters had gone out, though one suggested forwarding to one or more others. Then he logged off and shut his computer down. "Now let's see if we can identify his correspondence, shall we?" the senior investigator told his staff. That took all of 20 minutes. What had been routine drudgery was now as exciting as watching the World Cup football final. The Myasishchev M5 reconnaissance aircraft lifted off from Taza just before dawn. An odd-looking design with its twin booms, it was a 40 years too late Russian version of the venerable Lockheed U-2, able to cruise at 70,000 feet at a sedate 500 or so knots and take photographs in large numbers with high resolution. The pilot was an experienced Russian Air Force major with orders not to stray within 10 kilometers of the Chinese border. This was to avoid provoking his country's potential enemies, and that order was not as easy to execute as it had been to write down in Moscow, because the borders between countries are rarely straight lines. So the major programmed his autopilot carefully and sat back to monitor his instruments while the camera systems did all the real work. The main instrument he monitored was his threat receiver, essentially a radio scanner programmed to note the energy of radar transmitters. There were many such transmitters on the border, most of the low-to-mid-frequency search types. But then a new one came up. This was on the X-band, and it came from the south. And that meant that a Chinese surface-to-air missile battery was illuminating him with a tracking and targeting radar. That got his attention, because although 70,000 was higher than any commercial aircraft could fly,
and higher than many fighters could reach. It was well within the flight envelope of a SAM, as an American named Francis Gary Powers had once discovered over central Russia. A fighter could outmaneuver most SAMs, but the M5 was not a fighter and had trouble outmaneuvering clouds on a windless day. And so he kept his eye on the threat receiver's dials while his ears registered the shrill beep-beep of the aural alert. The visual display showed that the pulse repetition rate was in the tracking rather than the lock-up mode. So a missile was probably not in the air, and the sky was clear enough that he'd probably see the smoke trail that such missiles always left. And today, no smoke coming up from the ground. For defensive systems, he had only a primitive chaff dispenser and prayer. Not even a white noise jammer, the major groused. But there was no sense in worrying. He was 10 kilometers inside his own country's airspace, and whatever SAM systems the Chinese possessed were probably well inside their own borders. It would be a stretch for them to reach him, and he could always turn north and run while punching loose a few kilos of shredded aluminum foil to give the inbound missile something else to chase. As it played out, the mission involved 4 complete sweeps of the border region, and that required 90 otherwise boring minutes before he reprogrammed the M5 back to the old fighter base outside Taza. The ground crew supporting the mission had also been deployed from the Moscow area. As soon as the M5 rolled to a stop, the film cassettes were unloaded and driven to the portable film lab for development, then forwarded, still wet, to the interpreters. They saw few tanks, but lots of tracks in the ground, and that was all they needed to see. Chapter 49. Disarming. I know, Oleg. I understand that we developed the intelligence in Washington and forwarded it to your people immediately, Riley said to his friend. You must be proud of that, Provolov observed. Wasn't the Bureau that did it, Riley responded. The Russians would be touchy about having Americans provide them with such sensitive information. Maybe Americans would have reacted the same way. Anyway, what are you going to do about it? We are trying to locate his electronic correspondence. We have their addresses, and they are all on Russian-owned ISPs. FSS probably has them all identified by now. Arrest them when? When they meet Suvorov. We have enough to make the arrests now. Riley wasn't sure about that. The people Suvorov wanted to meet could always say that they came to see him by invitation without having a clue as to the purpose of the meeting. And a day-old member of the bar could easily enough sell the reasonable doubt associated with that to a jury. Better to wait until they all did something incriminating, and then squeeze one of them real hard to turn state's evidence on the rest. But the rules and the juries were different here. Anatoly, what are you thinking about? Golovko asked.
"Comrade Chairman, I am thinking that Moscow has suddenly become dangerous," Major Shalepin replied. "The idea of former Spetsnaz men conspiring to commit treason on this scale sickens me. Not just the threat, but also the infamy of it. These men were my comrades in the army, trained as I was to be guardians of the state."
The handsome young officer shook his head.
Well, when this place was the KGB, it happened to us more than once. It is unpleasant, yes, but it is reality. People are corruptible. It is human nature, Golovko said soothingly. Besides, the threat isn't against me now, he didn't add. An unworthy thought, perhaps, but that also was human nature. What is President Grushevoy's detail doing now?
Sweating, I should imagine. Who can say that this is the only threat? What if this Kong bastard has more than one such agent in Moscow? We should pick him up, too.
So we shall, when the time comes. He's been observed to do only one dead drop over the past week, and we control that one.
Yes, yes, I know, Sergei added, when he saw the beginnings of Anatoly's objections. He isn't the only MSS operative in Moscow, but he's probably the only one on this case.
Security considerations are universal. They must worry that one of their officers might be in our employ after all. There are many wheels in such an operation, and they don't all turn in the same direction, my young friend.
You know what I miss? I should imagine it is having the second chief directorate under the same roof. That way the operation would be run cooperatively.
Golovko smiled. Correct, Anatoly Ivanich. For now we can only do our job and wait for others to do theirs. And yes, waiting is never an entertaining way to spend one's time.
With that observation, both men resumed staring at the desk phones, waiting for them to ring.
The only reason that surveillance hadn't been tightened any more was that there wasn't enough room for the additional personnel, and Suvorov might take note of the 30 people who followed him everywhere. That day he awoke at his normal hour, washed up, had coffee and kasha for breakfast, left the apartment building at 9:15, and drove his car into the city, with a good deal of elusive company. He parked his car 2 blocks from Gorky Park and walked the rest of the way there. So did 4 others, also under surveillance. They met at a magazine kiosk at precisely 9:45 and walked together toward a coffee shop that was disagreeably crowded, too much so for any of the watchers to get close enough to listen in, though the faces were observed. Suvorov/Konyev did most of the talking, and the other 4 listened intently, and Nod started. Yefremov of the Federal Security Service kept his distance. He was senior enough that he could no longer guarantee that his face was unknown, and had to trust the more junior men to get in close, their earpieces removed and radio transmitters turned off, wishing they could read lips like the people in spy movies. For Pavel Georgievich Yefremov, the question was, what to do now? Arrest them all and risk blowing the case? Or merely continue to shadow, and risk having them go forward, and perhaps accomplish the mission? The question would be answered by one of the 4 contacts. He was the oldest of them, about 40, a Spetsnaz veteran of Afghanistan with the Order of the Red Banner to his name. His name was Igor Maximov. He held up his hand, rubbing forefinger and thumb, and, getting the answer to his question, he shook his head and politely took his leave. His departure was a cordial one, and his personal 2-man shadow team followed him to the nearest metro station while the others continued talking. On learning this, Yefremov ordered him picked up. That was done when he got off the metro train 5 kilometers away at the station near his flat, where he lived with his wife and son. The man did not resist and was unarmed. Docile as a lamb, he accompanied the 2 FSS officers to their headquarters. "Your name is Maximov Igor Ilyich," Yefremov told him. "You met with your friend Suvorov, Klementy Ivanich, to discuss participation in a crime. We want to hear your version of what was discussed."
"Comrade Yefremov, I met some old friends for coffee this morning and then I left. Nothing in particular was discussed. I do not know what you are talking about."
"Yes, of course," the FSS man replied.
"Tell me, do you know 2 former Spetsnaz men like yourself, Amalric and Zimyanin?"
"I've heard the names, but I don't know the faces."
"Here are the faces."
Yefremov handed over the photos from the Leningrad militia. "They are not pleasant to look upon."
Maximov didn't blanch, but he didn't look at the photos with affection either.
"What happened to them?"
"They did a job for your comrade, Suvorov, but he was evidently displeased with how they went about it, and so they went swimming in the River Neva.
Maximov, we know that you are Spetsnaz. We know that you earn your living today doing illegal things, but that is not a matter of concern to us at the moment. We want to know exactly what was said at the coffee shop. You will tell us this, the easy way or the hard way. The choice is yours."
When he wanted to, Yefremov could come on very hard to his official guests. In this case, it wasn't difficult.
Maximov was not a stranger to violence, at least on the giving side. The receiving side was something he had no wish to learn about.
What do you offer me?
I offer you your freedom in return for your cooperation. You left the meeting before any conclusions were reached. That is why you are here. So, do you wish to speak now? Or shall we wait a few hours for you to change your mind?
Maximov was not a coward. Spetsnaz didn't have many of those in Yefremov's experience.
But he was a realist, and realism told him that he had nothing to gain by non-cooperation.
He asked me and the others to participate in a murder. I presume it will be a difficult operation, otherwise why would he need so many men?
He offers for this 20,000 euros each. I decided that my time is more valuable than that.
Do you know the name of the target?
Maximov shook his head.
No. He did not say. I did not ask.
That is good.
You see, the target is President Grushevoy.
That got a reaction, as Maximov's eyes flared.
That is state treason, the former Spetsnaz sergeant breathed,
hoping to convey the idea that he'd never do such a thing. He learned fast.
Yes. Tell me, is 20,000 euros a good price for a murder?
I would not know.
If you want me to tell you that I have killed for money, no, Comrade Yefremov, I will not say that.
But you have, and you'd probably participate in this one if the price went high enough.
In Russia, 20,000 euros was a considerable sum. But Yefremov had much bigger fish to fry.
The others at the meeting, what do you know of them?
All are Spetsnaz veterans. Ilya Suslov and I served together east of Kandahar. He's a sniper, a very good one. The others, I know them casually, but I never served with them.
Sniper?
Well, those were useful, and President Grushevoy appeared in public a lot. He was scheduled to have an outdoor rally the very next day, in fact.
It was time to wrap this up.
So Suvorov spoke of a murder for hire?
Yes, he did.
Good. We will take your statement. You were wise to cooperate, Igor Ilyich.
Yefremov had a junior officer lead him away. Then he lifted his phone.
Arrest them all, he told the field commander.
The meeting broke up. We have all of them under surveillance. Suvorov is en route back to his flat with one of the three.
Well, assemble the team and arrest them both.
Feeling better? Colonel Aliyev asked.
What time is it?
15:40, Comrade General, Colonel Aliyev replied. You slept for 13 hours. Here are some dispatches from Moscow.
You let me sleep that long?
The general demanded, instantly angry.
The war has not begun. Our preparations, such as they are progressing, and there seems no sense in waking you.
Oh, we have our first set of reconnaissance photos. Not much better than the American ones we had faxed to us. Intelligence has firmed up its estimate. It's not getting any better. We have support now from an American Elint aircraft, but they tell us that the Chinese aren't using their radios, which is not a surprise.
God damn it, Andrei!
The general responded, rubbing his unshaven face with both hands.
So, court-martial me after you've had your coffee.
I got some sleep, too. You have a staff, I have a staff, and I decided to let them do their jobs while we slept,
the operations officer said defiantly.
What of the Nevers depot?
We have a total of 180 tanks operating with full crews. Shorter on the infantry component and artillery, but the reservists seem to be functioning with some degree of enthusiasm, and the 265th motor rifle is starting to act like a real division for the first time.
Aliyev walked over a mug of coffee with milk and sugar, the way Bondarenko preferred it.
Drink, Gennady Yosifovich.
Then he pointed to a table piled with buttered bread and bacon.
"If we live, I will see you promoted, Colonel."
"I've always wanted to be a general officer, but I want to see my children enter university, too. So let's try to stay alive."
"What of the border troops?"
"I have transport assigned to each post. Where possible, two sets of transport. I've sent some of the reservists in BTRs to make sure they have a little protection against the artillery fire when they pull out. We have a lot of guns in the photos from the M5, Comrade General. And fucking mountains of shells. But the border troops have ample protection, and the orders have gone out so that they will not need permission to leave their posts when the situation becomes untenable. At the company officer level, that is," Aliyev added. "Commissioned officers were less likely to bug out than enlisted men."
"No word on when?"
The G3 shook his head.
"Nothing helpful from intelligence. The Chinese are still moving trucks and such around, from what we can tell. I'd say another day, maybe as many as three."
"So?" Ryan asked.
"So the overheads show they're still moving the chess pieces on the board," Foley answered. "But most of them are in place."
"What about Moscow?"
"They're going to arrest their suspect soon. Probably going to pick up the control officer in Moscow, too. They'll sweat him some, but he does have diplomatic immunity, and you can't squeeze him much."
Ed Foley remembered when KGB had arrested his wife in Moscow. It hadn't been pleasant for her, and less so for him. But they hadn't roughed her up either. Messing with people who traveled on diplomatic passports didn't happen often, despite what they'd seen on TV a few weeks before. And the Chinese probably regretted that one a lot, pronouncements on the Zorga feeds to the contrary notwithstanding.
"Nothing from inside to encourage us?"
"Nope."
The DCI shook his head.
"We ought to start moving the Air Force," Vice President Jackson urged.
"But then it could be seen as a provocation," Secretary Adler pointed out. "We can't give them any excuse."
"We can move 1st Armored into Russia, say it's a joint training exercise with our new NATO allies," Tomcat said. "That could buy us a few days."
Ryan weighed that and looked over at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
"Well, General?"
"It can't hurt all that much. They're already working with Deutsche Rail to get the move organized."
"Then do it," the president ordered.
"Yes, sir."
General Moore moved to make the call. Ryan checked his watch.
"I have a reporter to talk to."
"Have fun," Robbie told his friend. Zhigansk, on the west side of the Lena River, had once been a major regional air defense center for the old Soviet PVO Strani, the Russian Air Defense Command. It had a larger-than-average airfield with barracks and hangars, and had been largely abandoned by the new Russian military, with just a caretaker staff to maintain the facility in case it might be needed someday. This turned out to be a piece of lucky foresight, because the United States Air Force started moving in that day, mainly transport aircraft from the central part of America that had staged through Alaska and flown over the North Pole to get there. The first of 30 C-5 Galaxy transports landed at 10 in the morning local time, taxiing to the capacious but vacant ramps to offload their cargo under the direction of ground crewmen who'd ridden in the large passenger area aft of the wing box in the huge transports. The first things wheeled off were the Dark Star UAVs. They looked like loaves of French bread copulating atop slender wings, and were long-endurance, stealthy reconnaissance drones that took 6 hours to assemble for flight. The crews got immediately to work, using mobile equipment shipped on the same aircraft. Fighter and attack aircraft came into Sun Tar, far closer to the Chinese border, with tankers and other support aircraft, including the American E-3 Sentry AWACS birds, just west of there at Mirny. At these two air bases, the arriving Americans found their Russian counterparts, and immediately the various staffs started working together.
American tankers could not refuel Russian aircraft, but to everyone's relief, the nozzles for ground fueling were identical. And so the American aircraft could make use of the take fuel from the Russian JP storage tanks, which they found were huge, and mainly underground to be protected against nuclear airbursts. The most important element of cooperation was the assignment of Russian controllers to the American AWACS, so that Russian fighters could be controlled from the American radar aircraft. Almost at once, some E-3s lifted off to test this capability, using arriving American fighters as practice targets for controlled intercepts. They found immediately that the Russian fighter pilots reacted well to the directions, to the pleased surprise of the American controllers. They also found almost immediately that the American attack aircraft couldn't use Russian bombs and other ordnance. Even if the shackle points had been the same, they weren't, the Russian bombs had different aerodynamics from their American counterparts, and so the computer software on the American aircraft could not hit targets with them. It would have been like trying to jam the wrong cartridge into a rifle. Even if you could fire the round, the sights would send it to the wrong point of impact. So the Americans would have to fly in the bombs to be dropped, and shipping bombs by air was about as efficient as flying in gravel to build roads. Bombs came to fighter bases by ship, train, truck, and forklift, not by air. For this reason, the B-1s and other heavy strike aircraft were sent to Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, where there were some bomb stores to be used, even though they were a long way from the supposed targets. The air forces of the two sides established an immediate and friendly rapport, and in hours, as soon as the American pilots had gotten a little mandated crew rest, they were planning and flying missions together with relative ease. The quarter horse went first. Under the watchful eyes of Lieutenant Colonel Angelo Giusti, the M1A2 main battle tanks and M3 Bradley cavalry scout vehicles rolled onto the flat cars of Deutsche Rail, accompanied by the fuel and other support trucks. Troops went into coaches at the head end of the train consists and were soon heading east to Berlin, where they'd change over to the Russian gauge cars for the further trip east. Oddly, there were no TV cameramen around at the moment, Giusti saw. That couldn't last, but it was one less distraction for the unit that was the eyes of First Tanks. The division's helicopter brigade was sitting at its own base, awaiting the availability of Air Force transports to ferry them east. Some genius had decided against having the aircraft fly themselves, which, Giusti thought, they were perfectly able to do. But General Diggs had told him not to worry about it. Giusti would worry about it, but not out loud. He settled into a comfortable seat in the lead passenger coach, along with his staff, and went over maps just printed up by the division's cartography unit, part of the intelligence shop. The map showed the terrain they might be fighting for. Mostly they predicted where the Chinese would be going, and that wasn't overly demanding.
"So what are we going to do?" Bob Holtzman asked.
"We're beginning to deploy forces to support our allies," Ryan answered. "We hope that the PRC will see this and reconsider the activities that now appear to be underway."
"Have we been in contact with Beijing?"
"Yes," Ryan nodded soberly. "The DCM of our embassy in Beijing, William Kilmer, delivered a note from us to the Chinese government, and we are now awaiting a formal reply."
"Are you telling us that you think there will be a shooting war between Russia and China?"
"Bob, our government is working very hard to forestall that possibility. And we call on the Chinese government to think very hard about its position and its actions. War is no longer a policy option in this world.
I suppose it once was, but no longer.
War only brings death and ruin to people. The world has turned a corner on this thing. The lives of people, including the lives of soldiers, are too precious to be thrown away. Bob, the reason we have governments is to serve the needs and the interests of people, not the ambitions of rulers. I hope the leadership of the PRC will see that."
Ryan paused.
A couple of days ago, I was at Auschwitz.
Bob, that was the sort of experience to get you thinking.
You could feel the horror there. You could hear the screams, smell the death smell. You could see the lines of people being led off under guns to where they were murdered.
Bob, all of a sudden, it wasn't just black-and-white TV anymore.
It came to me then that there is no excuse at all for the government of a country, any country, to engage in killing for profit. Ordinary criminals rob liquor stores to get money. Countries rob countries to get oil or gold or territory. Hitler invaded Poland for Lebensraum, for room for Germany to expand. But damn it, there were already people living there. And what he tried to do was to steal. That's all. Not statecraft, not vision. Hitler was a thief before he was a murderer. Well, the United States of America will not stand by and watch that happen again.
Ryan paused and took a sip of water.
One of the things you learn in life is that there's only one thing really worth having, and that's love. Well, by the same token, there's only one thing worth fighting for, and that is justice. Bob, that's what America fights for, and if China launches a war of aggression, a war of robbery, America will stand by her ally and stop it from happening.
Many say that your policy toward China has helped to bring this situation about, that your diplomatic recognition of Taiwan...
Ryan cut him off angrily.
Bob, I will not have any of that. The Republic of China's government is a freely elected one. America supports democratic governments.
Why?
Because we stand for freedom and self-determination. Neither I nor America had anything to do with the cold-blooded murders we saw on TV, the death of the papal nuncio, Cardinal Demilo, and the killing of the Chinese minister Yu Fa'an. We had nothing to do with that. The revulsion of the entire civilized world came about because of the PRC's actions. Even then, China could have straightened it out by investigating and punishing the killers. But they chose not to, and the world reacted to what they did all by themselves.
But what is this all about? Why are they massing troops on the Russian border?
It appears that they want what the Russians have, the new oil and gold discoveries. Just as Iraq once invaded Kuwait. It was for oil. For money, really. It was an armed robbery, just like a street thug does, mugging an old lady for her social security check, but somehow, for some reason, we sanctify it when it happens at the nation-state level.
Well, no more, Bob. The world will no longer tolerate such things. And America will not stand by and watch this happen to our ally. Cicero once said that Rome grew great not through conquest, but rather through defending her allies. A nation acquires respect from acting for things, not against things. You measure people not by what they are against, but by what they are for. America stands for democracy, for the self-determination of people. We stand for freedom. We stand for justice. We've told the People's Republic of China that if they launch a war of aggression, then America will stand with Russia and against the aggressor. We believe in a peaceful world order in which nations compete on the economic battlefield, not with tanks and guns. There's been enough killing. It's time for that to stop, and America will be there to make it stop.
The world's policeman? Holtzman asked.
Immediately the president shook his head.
Not that. But we will defend our allies, and the Russian Federation is an ally. We stood with the Russian people to stop Hitler.
We stand with them again, Ryan said.
And again we send our young people off to war?
There need be no war, Bob. There is no war today. Neither America nor Russia will start one. That question is in the hands of others. It isn't hard. It isn't demanding for a nation-state to stand its military down. It's a rare professional soldier who relishes conflict. Certainly no one who's seen a battlefield will voluntarily rush to see another. But I'll tell you this. If the PRC launches a war of aggression, and if because of them American lives are placed at risk, then those who make the decision to set loose those dogs are putting their own lives at risk.
The Ryan Doctrine? Holtzman asked.
Call it anything you want. If it's acceptable to kill some infantry private for doing what his government tells him, then it's also acceptable to kill the people who tell the government what to do, the ones who send that poor, dumb private out in harm's way.
Oh, shit, Arnie Van Dam thought, hovering in the doorway of the Oval Office. Jack, did you have to say that?
Thank you for your time, Mr. President, Holtzman said. When will you address the nation?
Tomorrow.
God willing, it'll be to say that the PRC has backed off. I'll be calling Premier Xu soon to make a personal appeal to him.
Good luck.
We are ready, Marshal Luo told the others. The operation commences early tomorrow morning.
What have the Americans done?
They've sent some aircraft forward, but aircraft do not concern me, the defense minister replied. They can sting, as a mosquito does, but they cannot do real harm to a man. We will make 20 kilometers the first day, and then 50 per day thereafter. Maybe more, depending on how the Russians fight. The Russian Air Force is not even a paper tiger. We can destroy it, or at least push it back out of our way. The Russians are starting to move mechanized troops east on their railroad, but we will pound on their marshalling facility at Chita with our air assets. We can dam them up and stop them to protect our left flank until we move troops in to wall that off completely.
You are confident, Marshal? Zhang asked.
Rhetorically, of course.
We'll have their new gold mine in 8 days, and then it's 10 more to the oil, the Marshal predicted, as though describing how long it would take to build a house.
Then you are ready?
Fully, Luo insisted.
Expect a call from President Ryan later today, Foreign Minister Shen warned the Premier.
What will he say? Xu asked.
He will give you a personal plea to stop the war from beginning.
If he does, what ought I to say?
Have your secretary say you are out meeting the people, Zhang advised. Don't talk to the fool.
Minister Shen wasn't fully behind his country's policy, but nodded anyway. It seemed the best way to avoid a personal confrontation, which Xu would not handle well. His ministry was still trying to get a feel for how to handle the American president. He was so unlike other governmental chiefs that they still had difficulty understanding how to speak with him.
"What of our answer to their note?" Fang asked.
We have not given them a formal answer, Shen told him.
It concerns me that they should not be able to call us liars, Fang said. That would be unfortunate, I think.
You worry too much, Fang, Zhang commented, with a cruel smile.
No, in that he is correct, Shen said, rising to his colleague's defense. Nations must be able to trust the words of one another, else no intercourse at all is possible. Comrades, we must remember that there will be an after the war, in which we must be able to re-establish normal relations with the nations of the world. If they regard us as outlaw, that will be difficult.
That makes sense, Xu observed, speaking his own opinion for once.
No, I will not accept the call from Washington. And no, Fang, I will not allow America to call us liars.
One other development, Luo said. The Russians have begun high-altitude reconnaissance flights on their side of the border. I propose to shoot down the next one and say that their aircraft intruded on our airspace. Along with other plans, we will use that as a provocation on their part.
Excellent, Zhang observed.
So, John asked.
So, he is in this building, General Karelin clarified. The takedown team is ready to go up and make the arrest. Care to observe?
Sure, Clark agreed with a nod.
He and Chavez were both dressed in their rainbow ninja suits, black everything, plus body armor, which struck them both as theatrical. But the Russians were being overly solicitous to their hosts, and that included official concern for their safety.
How is it set up?
"We have 4 men in the apartment next door. We anticipate no difficulties," Karelin told his guests. "So, if you will follow me?"
"Waste of time, John," Chavez observed in Spanish.
"Yeah, but they want to do a show and tell."
The two of them followed Karelin and a junior officer to the elevator, which whisked them up to the proper floor. A quick, furtive look showed that the corridor was clear, and they moved like cats to the occupied apartment.
"We are ready, Comrade General," the senior Spetsnaz officer, a major, told his commander. "Our friend is sitting in his kitchen discussing matters with his guest. They are looking at how to kill President Grushevoy tomorrow on his way to Parliament. Sniper rifle," he concluded, "from 800 meters.
"You guys make good ones here," Clark observed.
800 was close enough for a good rifleman, especially on a slow-moving target like a walking man.
"Proceed, Major," Karelin ordered.
With that, the four-man team walked back out into the corridor. They were dressed in their own rainbow suits, black Nomex, and carrying the equipment Clark and his people had brought over, German MP-10 submachine guns and 45 Beretta sidearms, plus the portable radios from E-Systems. Clark and Chavez were wearing identical gear but not carrying weapons. Probably the real reason Karelin had brought them over, John thought, was to show them how much his people had learned. And that was fair enough. The Russian troopers looked ready, alert and pumped up, but not nervous, just the right amount of tenseness. The officer in command moved down the corridor to the door. His explosives man ran a thin line of detcord explosive along the door's edges and stepped aside, looking at his team leader for the word.
"Shoot," the major told him.
And before Clark's brain could register the single-word command, the corridor was sundered with the crash of the explosion that sent the solid core door into the apartment at about 300 feet per second. Then the Russian major and a lieutenant tossed in flashbangs, sure to disorient anyone who might have been there with a gun of his own. It was hard enough for Clark and Chavez, and they'd known what was coming and had their hands over their ears. The Russians darted into the apartment in pairs, just as they'd been trained to do, and there was no other sound, except for a scream down the hall from a resident who hadn't been warned about the day's activities. That left John Clark and Domingo Chavez just standing there, until an arm appeared and waved them inside. The inside was a predictable mess. The entry door was now fit only for kindling and toothpicks, and the pictures that decorated the wall did so without any glass in the frames. The blue sofa had a ruinous scorch mark on the right side, and the carpet was cratered by another flashbang. Suvorov and Suslov had been sitting in the kitchen, always the heart of any Russian home. That had placed them far enough away from the explosion to be unhurt, though both looked stunned by the experience, and well they might be. There were no weapons in evidence, which was surprising to the Russians, but not to Clark. And the two supposed miscreants were now face down on the tile floor, their hands manacled behind them, and guns not far behind their heads.
"Greetings, Clementi Ivanich," General Karelin said. "We need to talk."
The older of the two men on the floor didn't react much. First, he was not really able to, and second, he knew that talking would not improve his situation. Of all the spectators, Clark felt the most sympathy for him. To run a covert operation was tense enough. To have one blown, it had never happened to John, but he'd thought about the possibility often enough, was not a reality that one wished to contemplate. Especially in this place, though since it was no longer the Soviet Union, Suvorov could take comfort in the fact that things might have been a little worse. But not that much worse, John was sure. It was time for him to say something.
"Well executed, Major.
A little heavy on the explosives, but we all do that. I say that to my own people almost every time."
"Thank you, General Clark."
The senior officer of the strike team beamed, but not too much, trying to look cool for his subordinates. They'd just done their first real-life mission,
and pleased as they all were, the attitude they had to adopt was, "Of course we did it right." It was a matter of professional pride.
"So, Yuri Andreevich, what will happen with them now?" John asked, in his best Leningrad Russian.
"They will be interrogated for murder and conspiracy to commit murder, plus state treason. We picked up Kong half an hour ago, and he's talking," Karelin added, lying. Suvorov might not believe it, but the statement would get his mind wandering in an uncomfortable direction.
"Take them out," the general ordered.
No sooner had that happened than an FSS officer came in to light up the desktop computer to begin a detailed check of its contents. The protection program Suvorov had installed was bypassed because they knew the key to it, from the keyboard bug they'd installed earlier. Computers, they all agreed, must have been designed with espionage in mind. But they worked both ways.
"Who are you?" a stranger in civilian clothes asked.
"John Clark" was the surprising answer in Russian.
"And you?"
"Provolov. I am a lieutenant investigator with the militia."
"Oh, the RPG case?"
"Correct."
"I guess that's your man."
"Yes, a murderer."
"Worse than that," Chavez said, joining the conversation.
"There is nothing worse than murder," Provolov responded.
"Always the cop."
Chavez was more practical in his outlook.
"Maybe. Depends on if you need an accountant to keep track of all the bodies."
"So, Clark, what do you think of the operation?" Karelin asked, hungry for the American's approval.
"It was perfect. It was a simple operation, but flawlessly done. They're good kids, Yuri. They learn fast and they work hard. They're ready to be trainers for your special operations people."
"Yeah, I'd take any of them out on a job," Ding agreed.
Karelin beamed at the news, unsurprising as it was. Chapter 50 Thunder and Lightning.
"They got him," Murray told Ryan. "Our friend Clark was there to watch. Damned ecumenical of the Ruskies.
Just want to be an ally back to us, I suppose. And Rainbow is a NATO asset."
"You suppose he'll sing?"
"Like a canary, probably," the FBI director predicted. "The Miranda rule never made it to Russia, Jack. And their interrogation techniques are a little more, enthusiastic than ours are. Anyway, it's something to put on TV, something to get their public seriously riled up."
"So, boss, this war going to stop or go?"
"We're trying to stop it, Dan, but..."
"Yeah, I understand," Murray said. "Sometimes big shots act just like street hoods, just with bigger guns."
"This bunch has H-bombs," Jack didn't say. "It wasn't something you wanted to talk about right after breakfast." Murray hung up and Ryan checked his watch. It was time. He punched the intercom button on his phone.
"Ellen, could you come in, please?"
It took the usual 5 seconds.
"Yes, Mr. President."
"I need one, and it's time to call Beijing."
"Yes, sir."
She handed Ryan a Virginia Slim and went back to the anteroom. Ryan saw one of the phone lights go on and waited, lighting his smoke. He had his speech to Premier Xu pretty well canned, knowing that the Chinese leader would have a good interpreter nearby. He also knew that Xu would still be in the office. He'd been working pretty late over the past few days. It wasn't hard to figure out why. Starting a potential world war had to be a time-consuming business. So it would be less than 30 seconds to make the guy's phone ring. Then Ellen Sumter would talk to the operator on the far end. The Chinese had full-time switchboard operators rather than secretary receptionists, as in the White House. And the call would be put through. So figure another 30 seconds, and then Jack would get to make his case to Xu. "Let's reconsider this one, buddy, or something bad will happen. Bad for our country, bad for yours. Probably worse for yours." Mickey Moore had promised something called hyperwar, and that would be seriously bad news for someone unprepared for it. The phone light stayed on, but Ellen wasn't beeping him to get on the line. Why? Shu was still in his office. The embassy in Beijing was supposed to be keeping an eye on the guy. Ryan didn't know how, but he was pretty sure they knew their job. It might have been as easy as having an embassy employee, probably an agency guy, stand on the street with a cell phone and watch a lit-up office window, then report to the embassy, which would have an open line to Foggy Bottom, which had many open lines to the White House. But then the light on the phone blinked out, and the intercom started.
"Mr. President, they say he's out of the office," Mrs. Sumter said.
"Oh?" Ryan took a long puff. "Tell State to confirm his location."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Then 40 seconds of silence.
"Mr. President, the embassy says he's in his office as far as they can tell."
"And his people said?"
"They said he's out, sir."
"When will he be back?"
"I asked. They said they didn't know."
"Shit," Ryan breathed.
"Please get me Secretary Adler."
"Yeah, Jack," Sextate said a few seconds later. "He's dodging my call, Scott."
"Shu?"
"Yeah." "Not surprising. They, the Chinese Politburo, don't trust him to talk on his own without a script." "Like Arnie and me," Ryan thought, with a mixture of anger and humor. "Okay, what's it mean, Scott?"
"Nothing good, Jack," Adler replied. "Nothing good."
"So, what do we do now?"
"Diplomatically, there's not much we can do. We've sent them a stiff note, and they haven't answered. Your position vis-a-vis them and the Russian situation is as clear as we can make it. They know what we're thinking. If they don't want to talk to us, it means they don't care anymore."
"Shit."
"That's right," the Secretary of State agreed.
"You're telling me we can't stop it?"
"Correct."
Adler's tone was matter-of-fact.
"Okay, what else?"
"We tell our civilians to get the hell out of China. We're set up to do that here."
"Okay, do it," Ryan ordered, with a sudden flip of his stomach.
"Right. I'll get back to you."
Ryan switched lines and punched the button for the Secretary of Defense.
"Yeah?" Tony Britano answered. "It looks like it's going to happen," Ryan told him.
"Okay, I'll alert all the sinks."
In a matter of minutes, flash traffic was dispatched to each of the commanders-in-chief of independent commands. There were many of them, but at the moment the most important was Sink Pack, Admiral Bart Mancuso in Pearl Harbor. It was just after 3 a.m. when the stew next to his bed started chirping.
"This is Admiral Mancuso," he said, more than half asleep.
"Sir, this is the watch officer. We have a war warning from Washington. China. Expect the commencement of hostilities between the PRC and the Russian Federation to commence within the next 24 hours. You are directed to take all measures consistent with the safety of your command."
"Signed, Britano, SecDef, sir," the lieutenant commander told him.
Mancuso already had both feet on the floor of the bedroom.
"Okay, get my staff together. I'll be in the office in 10 minutes.
"Aye, aye, sir." The chief petty officer assigned to drive him was already outside the front door, and Mancuso noted the presence of 4 armed Marines in plain sight. The senior of them saluted while the others studiously looked outward at a threat that probably wasn't there, but might be. Minutes later, he walked into his hilltop headquarters overlooking the naval base. Brigadier General Lahr was there, waiting for him.
"How'd you get in so fast?" Sink Pack asked him.
"Just happened to be in the neighborhood, Admiral," the J-2 told him. He followed Mancuso into the inner office.
"What's happening?" The president tried to phone Premier Xu, but he didn't take the call. Not a good sign from our Chinese brethren, the theater intelligence officer observed. Okay, what's John Chinaman doing? Mancuso asked, as a steward's mate brought in coffee. Not much in our area of direct interest, but he's got a hell of a lot of combat power deployed in the Shenyang Military District. Most of it right up on the Amur River. Lar set up a map stand and started moving his hand on the acetate overlay, which had a lot of red markings on it. For the first time in his memory, Mancuso saw Russian units drawn in blue, which was the friendly color. It was too surprising to comment on. What are we doing? We're moving a lot of air assets into Siberia. The shooters are here at Suntar. Reconnaissance assets back here at Zhigansk. The Dark Stars ought to be up and flying soon. It'll be the first time we've deployed them in a real shooting war, and the Air Force has high hopes for them. We have some satellite overheads that show where the Chinese are. They've camouflaged their heavy gear, but the lacrosse imagery sees right through the nets. And? And it's over 500,000 men. 5 Group A mechanized armies. That's 1 armored division, 2 mechanized infantry, and 1 motorized infantry each, plus attachments that belong directly to the army commander. The forces deployed are heavy in tanks and APCs, fair in artillery, but light in helicopters. The air assets belong to somebody else. Their command structure for coordinating air and ground isn't as streamlined as it ought to be, and their air forces aren't very good by our standards. But their numbers are better than the Russians. Manpower-wise, the Chinese have a huge advantage on the ground. The Russians have space to play with, but if it comes down to a slugging match, bet your money on the People's Liberation Army. And at sea? Their navy doesn't have much out of port at the moment, but overhead show they're lighting up their boilers alongside. I would expect them to surge some ships out. Expect them to stay close in, defensive posture, deployment just to keep their coast clear. Mancuso didn't have to ask what he had out. 7th Fleet was pretty much out to sea after the warnings from previous weeks. His carriers were heading west. He had a total of 6 submarines camped out on the Chinese coast, and his surface forces were spun up. If the People's Liberation Army Navy wanted to play, they'd regret it. Orders? Self-defense only at this point, Lar said. Okay, we'll close to within 250 miles of their coast, minimum for surface ships. Keep the carriers an additional 100 back for now. The submarines can close in and shadow any planned forces at will, but no shooting unless attacked. And I don't want anyone counter-detected. The Chinese have that one recon sat up. I don't want it to see anything painted gray. Dodging a single reconnaissance satellite wasn't all that difficult, since it was entirely predictable in course and speed. You could even keep out of the way of 2. When the number got to 3, things became difficult. In the Navy, the day never starts, because the day never ends. But that wasn't true for a ship sitting in wooden blocks. Then things changed. If not to an 8-hour day, then at least to a semi-civilian job where most of the crew lived at home and drove in every morning, for the most part, to do their jobs. That was principally preventive maintenance, which is one of the U.S. Navy's religions. It was the same for Al Gregory. In his case, he drove his rented car in from the Norfolk Motel and blew a kiss at the rent-a-cop at the guard shack, who waved everyone in. Once there had been armed Marines at the gates, but they'd gone away when the Navy had been stripped of its tactical nuclear weapons. There were still some nukes at the Yorktown Ordnance Station, because the Trident warheads hadn't yet all been disassembled out at Pantex in Texas, and some still occupied their mainly empty bunkers up on the York River, awaiting shipment west for final disposal. But not at Norfolk.